Accession number 24573, Real 10.
Mr. Darcy, Real 10. We're discussing the attacks on the submarine. I don't suppose you know the number of this submarine.
Yeah, oh yes, yes.
Which one was this?
This submarine was U-358.
Now, Gwinner had resolved to try and exhaust
That's right.
Now, what happened?
The next thing was, on the second day, that is to say, after 24 hours had passed since the initial contact, he then decided that he would try something, a tactic which had been used the previous year, I think, for the very first time, by Captain Walker, the anti-submarine ace in HMS Starling. This was known as a creep attack. We had never done it. We'd read about it, and he had read about it, so we knew how it worked. So it was decided that we would do a creep attack.
Now, what was this?
In this submarine, and this is done as in the following way: the control ship maintains contact with the submarine through ASDIC at about 1,000 yards distance. It manoeuvres itself, it plots the submarine's course in the normal way, and manoeuvres itself into a position astern of the submarine. This is done at about 2 or 3 knots of speed only. The attack ship or ships are then brought into position in front of the control ship, and in this case he used 3 ships for a simultaneous creep attack. There was Gore and 2 of the others, and I can't remember which of the 2 it was. And we were to steam under his control, because he kept control of us by means of the TBS, the talk between ships, and a handheld range finder, which he could use to keep to control the distance between us and him. And we were then manoeuvred into position in front of him and coming up astern of the submarine at very slow speed at about 5 knots. Now, normally, you drop depth charges at about 15 knots. At 5 knots, you would expect normally to blow your stern off. But in this case, in the case of a creep attack, where you're dealing with a very deep submarine, you're setting your depth charges to the maximum possible depth, which was, as I seem to remember, something like 600 feet. And this meant that the depth charges took approximately 60 seconds to reach this depth. They sank at the rate of about 10 feet per second. So a 600-foot setting would take approximately a minute to get there. And with a minute's grace between dropping the depth charge and moving away at 5 knots, you were probably far enough away not to damage yourself too seriously when the things went up. And the plan, of course, was to drop these charges without giving any warning to the submarine. We would be travelling so slowly, the engines would be turning over so slowly that the submarine might not even hear them and think that the only ship in contact with him was the control ship, which was 1,000 yards away. Anyway, we did this creep attack, and I've never seen anything like it in my life. 3 ships in line abreast, probably about 200 yards apart, 1 cable's length apart. And on the given instruction from Commander Gwinner, proceeding to drop depth charges set at around about the 600-foot mark, simultaneously, all 3 ships. When the explosions took place, as I have said in another place on another occasion, it was as if the wrath of God had descended on the sea. There was none of the usual spouts of water that you get from depth charges at more shallow depths. But the whole surface of the sea, over an area the size of possibly 3 football pitches, simply started to shudder and shake like a gigantic jelly. And the noise of the explosions hit our ships like enormous hammers on anvils. The most extraordinary experience. What it must have been like for the men in the submarine, I just cannot begin to imagine. Anyway, this procedure was carried out certainly more than once, twice, possibly 3 times, and still no result was obtained. We couldn't bring this thing to the surface.
Can I ask about, because I believe the actual impact of the explosion had an effect inside your
ship. I'm coming to that, sorry. Oh, indeed it did. After these creep attacks had been carried out, Commander Gwinner then reverted to his original idea and decided that there was absolutely nothing else to do except to hunt, to continue the hunt to exhaustion and wait for the thing to surface. Now, during the attacks, our first lieutenant was constantly on the move round the ship, looking to see that everyone was where they should be, that things were going as they should be going, and he also was looking in on the German prisoners, who the ratings, who were in the after mess deck, under the eye of a seaman wearing a big webbing belt with a Webley revolver in a holster. And he was quite amused to see them all busy shoring up bulkheads and acting in a very professional damage control manner. He said they were the most efficient damage control party he'd ever seen in the British ship. Not that there was any actual damage taking place to the hull, but it certainly sounded as if it was going to. Anyway, the result, as far as the internal part of the ship was concerned, was that most of the lavatory systems, lavatory pans, I should say, were cracked. All sorts of crockery and glass in the ship was broken as a result of these terrific impacts and noises and vibrations from the creep attack. So anyway, by this time, it's now the afternoon of the second day, and we in Gore then received an instruction from Commander Gwinner that we were to detach and go to Gibraltar because they wanted to see our prisoners. They wanted our prisoners to be landed, presumably, for debriefing. So we broke away from the group and left them to it. And we set sail for Gibraltar, where we duly landed all our prisoners and handed them over to the military. We were therefore, of course, not present when the final scenes took place with the U-358, but when we rejoined the group, we were told very graphically what had happened.
Can you just, to finish the story, tell us what did happen?
Yes. Apparently, after we had left, at approximately just after 1900 hours on the second day, that is to say, at almost 38 hours after the first contact, the group heard the sound of tanks being blown on the submarine, which indicated that it was commencing its journey to the surface. And they all waited for the thing to appear, which it finally did. And to everyone's absolute astonishment, as soon as the periscope broke water, the submarine fired a torpedo. And unluckily for us, It hit HMS Gould, causing very severe damage to the point where she sank. And lots of a very substantial number of the crew were lost, either in the explosion or in the sea as a result of going into the sea. We weren't there for that when that happened, but various members, other ships in the group, went in immediately to start rescuing survivors, whereas Affleck herself went in and destroyed the submarine, which was now on the surface, with depth charges which were put by the which were sent by the depth charge throwers, and which blew the thing, I understand, in half. There was only one survivor from the U-358. And he was in a very desperate condition mentally, and I really don't know what was ever discovered about the conditions on board, but they must have been absolutely horrendous. It was suggested to us later that quite possibly a number of the crew were already dead from lack of oxygen before the thing surfaced.
The length of this... that's the key point about this.
38 hours. It was from 5 o'clock, from half past five one morning until half past seven the following night. Not the same night, but the following night, which is 38 hours. It turned out that this particular hunt was the longest continuous hunt, successful hunt, of a submarine in the whole war, or any other war for that matter. A desperate situation, in fact, and obviously the captain of the U-358 must have been a very clever man, a very clever handler of his ship, and a very brave and very determined man to do what he did, when instead of surfacing and possibly surrendering, which he could have done, and saved his life and the life of his crew. Did what he did, in fact, and destroyed the Gould, and lost his own life in the process.
Now,
so
you, of course, were at Gibraltar.
That's right.
What was happening at Gibraltar? Well,
we
dropped the prisoners, obviously.
Yeah, we waited then in Gibraltar, and the group came in a little later. The rest of the group turned up a little later, and those of us who'd been involved in the creep attacks. We were all sent up the Mediterranean to Oran, which where there was an American base at Oran, at a place called Mers El Kabir, which is the port of the city of Oran. And we went up there in order to replace all the broken china and glass, which was of particular American origin and which had to be replaced by American equipment. So that was it. We went up there, and then we came back to Gibraltar, and from there, the group returned to Belfast without any further submarine activity on our part, although I believe that Affleck, on some detached mission of her own, was involved with a submarine somewhere off the Spanish coast, but I don't know any great details. About that.
Was there any sort of reception? Was this the time when you had the reception?
Yeah. When we finally got back to Belfast, we returned to what you could only describe as a hero's reception. We were met in the Pollock Dock by the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, a man called Sir Basil Brooke, with his cabinet. And the Royal Ulster Constabulary Band, and a large number of civic dignitaries of one sort and another, and press and all the rest of it. And we received a civic reception. I sometimes think that this was done in a way to compensate for what had been happening at Liverpool in previous on previous occasions, when Captain Walker and his group, the second escort group, had come into Liverpool in a similar triumphant manner with German submarines on their fuselages, if you like. But in any event, it was a very rewarding experience to be there when all this was going on.
Was morale good? Because you'd sunk two as a group.
Oh yes, yes. But we'd lost a ship, and this was not a nice thing. This was something that we all absolutely hated. Fortunately, I suppose, from that point of view, we hadn't been together as a group long enough for us all to have made very great friends with the blokes in HMS Gould. We'd met some of them at the parties in Belfast, and that was about it. As things went on during the war, and the group were together for a much longer period of time, this changed rather, and we got very friendly with various officers in the other ships. But at that point, we couldn't have a lot of personal grief because we didn't know the people very well on board Gould. We'd met them, but that was it. Anyway, after that, the group continued. The next thing was we got a replacement for Gould. This was called the Whittaker. HMS Whittaker came along and replaced Gould. And again, sad to say, we never really got to know Whittaker, because on either our first or was it our second trip, I can't remember, she was torpedoed.
Well, we'll come to that. What's the next mission you remember?
After that, they all tend to rather merge one into the other. We used to spend weeks at sea, probably three to four weeks at a time, out in the Atlantic. We usually would refuel, probably from a convoy, at some point during these patrols. Because, as you'll appreciate, we were not acting as convoy escorts. We were an independent hunting group, and we only went near convoys when we were acting as special additional escorts in dangerous areas, or most dangerous areas. And on these occasions, we would take advantage of the fact that there were oil tankers in the convoy, and we would refuel at sea. We would, of course, get diesel oil, and the turbo electric ships would get fuel oil. Anyway, Whittaker was lost on either the first or second trip that we went on.
Were you aware of did you see it happen? What happened?
No, it happened again in the middle of the night. This happened in the middle of the night. I wasn't on watch at the time when it happened. A shipmate of mine, whom I've spoken to not very long ago, Jim Luff, I think did see it happen. I think he was acting as a bridge lookout or something. When the flash occurred, and Whittaker was torpedoed off the northwest coast of Ireland, as far as I recall, the description was off Innistrahull. And anyway, we in Gore went alongside Whittaker, what was left of her. She'd been hit forward of the bridge. And this not only had the torpedo exploded, but I think one of the forward magazines had exploded as well. And basically, the whole fore part of the ship, everything forward of the bridge structure, had disappeared. It's an absolute marvel that she was still floating, but bulkheads obviously held, and she was the wreck, which is all she was left floating in the sea. We nosed alongside her quarter, can't remember if it was the port quarter or starboard quarter, and all the living and wounded survivors came aboard us. It was a very desperate situation. It was in the middle of the night. And it was awful.
What state were they in?
Pretty shocked. Pretty shocked. Anyway, they were spread about the ship in various messes and given food and drink and generally looked after as best we could. And the sick bay artificer, Gillam, went around and did his best, which was very good. He was a very good man. I think he worked for the Daily Express after that. But anyway, that's what happened. But the first lieutenant, our first lieutenant, all the officers were lost, by the way. Something I hadn't mentioned earlier. In the Gould, all the officers were lost. Not one survived. In the Whittaker, exactly the same situation occurred. All the officers were lost. This, of course, is because the officers lived forward, and those who were on the bridge and in their quarters were simply blown to bits with the explosions. And there was a terrible situation. Anyway, our first lieutenant and a party of five or six, maybe seven men, were left on board the wreck with the job of tidying up as much as they could. There were bodies and bits of bodies all over the place, and the whole thing was an absolute mess. And they were left on board, and we took Whittaker in tow. We naturally, we towed her stern first. There wasn't anything forward to tow from, as you'll appreciate. Nothing at all. So we towed her stern first, and in the daylight, when morning came, sometime during the morning, I got the job of taking down some food and drink to the first lieutenant and the other chaps who were on board. And this was done by dropping a Kali float into the water, into the sea, on the end of a long grass line. And I climbed down into the Kali float, and I was given waterproof parcels of sandwiches, corned beef if I remember correctly, and big containers, rather like enormous thermos flasks of, I can't remember if it was hot coffee or hot soup, or anyway, hot drink for the chaps. And I was lowered away down to the wreck on the end of a line with this stuff in my Kali float. And I had to push my way around the stern, which looked like a cliff when I got to it. And they dropped a ladder over the side for me, and I went aboard, and all this food went aboard. And I stayed for a few minutes, spoke to the first lieutenant and the other men. And then I left them with their food and drink and got back in my Kali float and was towed back, pulled back to the Gore. Most extraordinary experience, I may say. That was my recollection of the wrecking of the Whittaker.
Did you get her back?
Oh, indeed, yes. We towed her slowly back towards... We must have been towing her back towards Londonderry, the River Foyle, because eventually a big ocean-going tug came out, took over the tow, and relieved us of our duty. The first lieutenant and the other men came back on board, were put back aboard by the tug, as far as I remember, and she then took the wreck away. You've seen photographs, I think. So that was Whittaker. Well, now
anything other happened in these? Anything else in these anti? You know, these general sweeps. You don't remember one by one.
No, you can't. Nothing. No, there was nothing particular. We never got any more submarines at that stage. But
did you get many contacts? You know,
occasional ones, which turned out to be whales or shoals of fish or something like that. But no more actual submarines. But at the end of March, I received notification that my brother had been killed. My brother was a pilot in the RAF, and he'd been killed, unfortunately, in a flying accident in Lincolnshire. But I wasn't able to get leave to go to the funeral because it had already taken place by the time I got the information, before I got back to Belfast. So I was unable to attend his funeral. Then, of course, we were beginning to get ready for the invasion of Normandy. This, you'll appreciate, was sort of March, April 1944, and we knew that something was going to happen, but we didn't know when, we didn't know exactly what. But eventually, sometime, I suppose it must have been in May, we got these highly official envelopes that could only be opened on certain days and had to be kept in the personal custody of the commanding officer, etc., etc., etc. And we knew that this is what it was going to be. Anyway, prior to the invasion of Normandy, the group, 1st Escort Group, were sent into the Irish Sea, and we were told to go to the Isle of Anglesey, and we were to anchor in a place called Mulfrey Bay. I think it's spelt M-O-E-L-F-R-E, Mulfrey Bay, and wait further instructions, and which we did, and we stayed there until the appropriate day when we had to open up the first envelope of invasion instructions. And the captain opened this, and this told us what we were going to be doing and where we were going to be doing it. And basically, we were going to be part of a force of ships that were going to be deployed off the northwest corner of France with the task of stopping German submarines coming up from the Atlantic ports of Brest and Saint-Nazaire and so on to interfere with the invasion. And this is where we were located during the period of the actual invasion on the 6th of June.